your event to the commencing with the competition commission. Let's start there, folks. And then after your presentation, we take that of your sister organization. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm going to I'm going in this presentation to just talk through how the Competition Commission has thought through what it is going to do in the next 3 years. I'll talk a little bit about the process, how we planned it, what priorities we've come up with, and then look at the broad, at the big level, the budget implications and expense trends going forward. Okay. About the end of the year 2006, in October, November, we began in the Commission a strategic planning process to consolidate the experience of the organization up to that point and to understand more deeply the what we were doing, what competition regulation is all about in the context within which we were doing it. We also, after the experience we've gained up to now, have to look at where the institution has been effective, what the problems have been, and try to kind of improve those with the objective of attempting to improve those. Also, in that period up to then, there appeared to be different expectations around what stakeholders wanted from us, and we needed to understand that more deeply as well. We also needed to look internally into the organization and evaluate how the organization runs, how information flows in the organization, how decisions are taken, whether the structure of the organization was appropriate to what it was meant to be doing, and we needed to understand what the budgetary implications of all of that was. We went through a very participatory strategic planning process involving all of our staff, making input into it, as well as involving external people, representatives of business, of labor, of the DGI made inputs into this process so that we could understand from them the context within which we were working. The end result of all of this, what we came out of the whole process at the end, were five strategic priorities that we set out for the organization. The first of these, very importantly, was to increase staff morale and motivation. I'll speak to each one of these in a little more detail after I just go through them. Secondly, to define and clarify the Commission's approach and methodology, and here what we intend, what the idea was here, was that we kind of clearly understand how we approach our work. How do we prioritize our work? What do we see as more important, and what method we use in going about doing that? We also felt the third of those priorities was to fix the organization, the structure of the organization, to ensure that it is appropriate for us to achieve the priorities we set up. Fourthly, we want to turn the Commission into an organization that becomes known for its expertise. We want to improve expertise in the organization, knowledge management in the organization, and manage the information that we get more appropriately. And lastly, the last priority was for us to become more effective in our advocacy and communication role, which is about reporting our successes better, ensuring that people understand what it is that we do, and develop an appreciation for what we do amongst the population more generally. I'm going to deal with each one of these now. We'll look at what we thought through in each one of for each one of these priorities. Okay, the first one was about increasing staff morale and motivation. Now, here, to say that, you know, an institution like the competition commission, as I suppose with other kind of government institutions like ours, staff turnover is quite a chronic problem. We have a steady kind of we have a steady rate of resignations and recruitment in the organization that I said is pretty high. It kind of ranges between 15% to 20% a year of people who are leaving the organization. The profile of our organization is is mostly young, recently graduated professional people, namely lawyers and economists, that tend to have a lot of opportunities open to them, and they test out different jobs, and one of them will be in an institution like the commission, and they tend to move on. We felt that we needed to devise strategies to kind of live with this problem. So the two parts of our strategy would be around ensuring that that we kind of recruit people as quickly as they leave, which is something this graph shows that we're able to do. And to grow our own people in the organization, which is something I'll speak about in the next book. We tend to lose a lot of staff to the private sector, but increasingly also to other regulators, and in the recent past also to other international competition agencies. So for example, we've got 3 people leaving the organization now going to the New Zealand Competition Authority. And in the past we've had people who've left and have gone to the competition authority based in Ireland. People leave mostly, salaries appears to be a big issue for staff that are leaving. They seem to be able to get better salaries elsewhere. And so part of what we must do, and part of what we're putting a lot of effort into is, in the first instance, how do we kind of retain our good staff? How do we incentivize them? How do we keep, you know, and secondly, to kind of ensure that we're able to recruit as quickly as we do the staff. So the upshot of this aspect of our strategy is to essentially to recognize the efforts of staff to put into place good performance management systems, to improve our learning and development strategies, staff development strategies within the organization. And we've prioritized this issue since the adoption of our strategic plan, and a lot of work has been done already in terms of revising our reward, remuneration, progression policies. We've begun reviewing our HR policies. We've also undertaken a survey of salaries of equivalent jobs to those in the Competition Commission and benchmarked those against market-related salaries, and we've made proposals, for example, to the DGI to get our salary structure in keeping with market-related salaries. That's a proposal that's currently with the DGI, and they from what I've heard, they're viewing it favorably, and they will get back to us on it. Also important here is the issue of growing our own staff, growing our own talent, growing our own skills. And we have quite a relatively large graduate trainee program where we employ 15 to 20 graduate trainees. These are people just out of university who have no job experience, and they're with us for a year, and they receive, they get work experience and appropriate training, and some of them are kept in the organization. So that's one of our ways of growing our own staff, so that they can feed into the organization as people leave. The second of our strategic objectives was around refining our approach and methodology. And here, what we've done is we've developed a framework and a way to go about thinking, to go about determining how we decide what our priorities are. And we've said, this is something I've also covered in some amount of detail in my last presentation to this committee, but the criteria we've used for prioritizing our work is firstly to look back into the experience of the organization in all the cases it's been dealing with up to now. And there's a lot of information that comes out in the course of dealing with all these cases that gives us a pretty good idea of where competition problems might exist in the economy. So we wanted to kind of tap into that experience and then wisely going forward decide what is and what isn't important. But other more objective criteria are to look at to prioritize those cases that have an impact on end consumers, in particular poorer consumers, to prioritize those cases that increase the cost of intermediate goods into the manufacturing sector, which is the more labor-absorbing sector, and this criterion aligns us with industrial policy and overarching economic policy. And lastly, to look at those cases that impact negatively on the cost of doing business in South Africa. Applying these criteria, what we've come up with is a set of priority sectors that going forward this institution will now pay particular attention to. And these are listed here. Firstly, we're going to look at one of our priorities is the financial sector, specifically banking. And you're all aware that we have in the last year or so had a banking inquiry, which will finalize and release its report around the end of April. So that's coming up soon, and then we would have to process that report based on whatever recommendations that report makes both to us and to the Minister of Trade and Industry. It would seem that what's emerging from this issue is that there are issues relating to ATM fees. There are issues relating to the cost of transactions generally, and issues relating to the governance of the banking regulatory system. So, the likely outcomes here would be, firstly, this report would enable us to launch a more formal investigation into one or other aspect that the report identifies, but more importantly, the other work that would arise out of this report is to fix the governance arrangements around regulating banking, which is something that would fall under the responsibility of the Department of Finance and Treasury and the Reserve Bank. So we would have to play a role there in persuading those other departments that this needs to be serious rethink, and it needs to be reorganized in a way that where the regulation of banks is not self-regulation, which is pretty much what it is right now, and there's more objectivity. There are other stakeholders, in other words, in the fora that regulate banks, and not just the banks themselves. The second priority sector is around infrastructure and construction. And here we've set up a team to look at a range of issues, the costs of building materials being an important one, brick, cement, steel, aggregates on the one hand, and on the other hand, the other issue being dealt with in this section, under this heading, is to look at the bidding processes, to look at whether there have been any bid rigging for tenders, particularly the big construction projects that are going on right now. The third area, the third priority sector that we're looking at is agro-processing, specifically food processing and forestry. We've had a number of high-profile cases in food, which this committee is aware of. We're going to continue with this work. We're currently doing some research in scoping the food sector very broadly and looking at whether there are other areas in this sector with high costs, with high prices, where we might want to look more into more detail, investigate more further those particular markets. The fourth priority sector is intermediate industrial products, and here we're talking mostly about chemicals and steel. And there are a number of cases that we're currently finalizing, some of which are currently even before the tribunal. We've got a case in fertilizer, for example. We've had a number of steel. We've had some high-profile steel cases as well. And this is an area that we will continue to look at and pay particular attention to. So this is an important slide because this kind of slide tells us now what are we concentrating on, what are the areas we are really going to be looking at in more detail going forward. Taking decisions like what your priorities are has a number of kind of knock-on implications, which we'll talk about. You just don't decide. You then have to reorganize the institution to enable you to do this work. So, you know, Tulani set up an infrastructure team of people looking just at infrastructure. There's some kind of organizational implications to this. Now, one of the kind of cross-cutting organizational implications on everything that we do is about our ability to intelligently use the information that we have at our disposal. And here we've put together a very exciting project in the organization around improving our knowledge management systems. This is how we, to put into place, to understand more deeply and then to put into place processes that are able to mobilize both internal and external information and resources for proper use. There's a vast amount of information that comes to these authorities, to both the Commission and the Tribunal, in the filings that people give us, and we, you know, there has been a tendency to see each case as a case by itself and not look at the history of that particular market or of that particular firm. We need to kind of dip into our past experience and previous information that we received in order to make good decisions going forward. So this project essentially, we've begun already. It's a big project as part of implementing our strategic plan. We've already kind of reviewed workflow and communication within the organization. We'll review and develop more our case management and information management systems. This will have a big IT component to it. And we want, but more at a kind of cultural level within the organization, that the organizational culture must change to one of greater amounts of information sharing, collecting and retaining information. You know, our researchers and analysts must work in that mode, in that cultural mode, and that's something that sounds grand, but I can see in the short period that we've been dealing with this, people of the organization are open to it, and there is to some extent this cultural change already. Now, all of this then in the end requires some level of organizational change of the structure of the organization to ensure that the structure is best suited to meet these objectives, that we organize ourselves properly. And this is another, both in terms of existing resources, so we can organize existing resources better, but a lot of these projects need additional resources. So we need to understand what that means for how the organization is run, how communication occurs within it, what the roles and responsibilities of the different units are, and we need to kind of maximize synergies between the different divisions, increase coordination within the organization, ensure that we have the right people for the job, the right skills, the right resources, and to look at where the gaps might be so those can be filled. We've already begun some of this in the organization. So, you know, the one thing I can report on is that, insofar as clearly going forward, the Competition Commission is going to expand as an organization, and we've already been able, for example, to secure additional office space for us in the DTI campus to house these new projects. And that's something that will happen very soon. Okay, then the fourth or the third of our strategic objectives is around advocacy and communication. And here, this part of our work is something we've been doing steadily up to now, but we feel there's a need for us to step up on this. And the objectives here would be, firstly and importantly, to kind of promote policy consistency with competition principles in all the other government policies and legislation that is being put out. So we already get a lot of requests from other government departments and other regulators to advise and to assist them in ensuring that their policies are consistent with competition principles. We give advisory opinions to government departments, and there's a lot of interaction around that, and we think that this is and we're increasingly being used by other government. In other words, we being approached by them to say, look, we've got this act, we've got this policy, will you look at it and tell us if there's any competition problems in it? That's an area we think that we will increase our work in. In addition to that, the advocacy and communication function is there generally to promote compliance with the Competition Act. So it's not the stick of enforcement, but it's the moral suasion. It's the persuading people that, look, you know, it's in your interest to kind of comply with this law. And we give a lot of talks to business organizations. We have a lot of interaction with them. And it's an area that we think we need to kind of expand our work in. Thirdly, and also very importantly, around advocacy and communication, is that we think that this is something we've also had some level of success in recently. We think that consumer organizations and other civil society organizations should be given greater voice in the proceedings of the competition authority. That we could benefit from understanding directly from consumers how they feel about a particular issue or what their views might be or what interests they have that they need to advance. We have, for example, seen in the Tiger Brands case, in the Tiger Brands consent order, at the hearings before the Competition Tribunal, the participation of a number of civil society organizations, amongst them the National Consumer Forum, COSATU, the Black Sash, the Human Rights Commission, and we want that strengthens the decision-making process and makes us more sensitive to the needs of consumers in whose name we essentially are doing all of these things. And so it's not only at the hearing stage, but also in the investigation stage, these organizations can provide us, we think, with meaningful information to put together a case for prosecution. Very, very broadly speaking, then, the whole advocacy and communication role would be about creating greater transparency in markets and getting all the stakeholders and role players to understand more deeply how these markets work, and it's through the processes that we go through and information being made public. It's through the processes of the competition authorities that some information gets made public that otherwise would have not been made public, and this is a valuable thing in its own right. And then lastly, around this issue of advocacy and communication, we are and have begun to build strategic alliances with other organizations, in particular other regulators, government departments, the trade union movements, practitioners. We have, for example, four practitioners. We have two or three meetings with them a year, and where we kind of look at what their needs are and understand what their interests are and keep them informed of developments in the organization. We do a similar thing with trade unions, where we have once a year a trade union forum discussing issues with them. Okay, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide, but this is just to show you how the commission is organized. The budget is drawn up according to the structure. We have six divisions, each one of them dealing with specific areas. The enforcement division goes for the cartels, investigates cases, both abuse of dominance and cartel cases. The mergers and acquisition division deals with approving mergers that are notified to the commission. The policy and research unit does economic analysis, both for the cases specifically, but more generally, and then a lot of the special projects we've spoken about, the scoping exercise, for example, in food, or the research on infrastructure gets done by PNR. The legal services division are the lawyers who basically prosecute the cases or deal with any other litigation that emerges. They give legal advice and they manage essentially all the cases that we're dealing with. The compliance division does the advocacy work and both the internal and external communication in the organization. And the corporate services division is basically the housekeeping division that does the administrative, finance, IT, HR kind of area. Okay, I'm going to move now to some of the financial issues, and I'm going to speak about this in a very big picture way without going into kind of details of the actual amounts related to some of this. But this graph shows a trend in our expenditure since 2003, and you'll see that there's been quite a kind of steady increase, but as a consequence of our strategic planning, our proposed overall budget increase in the next period is significantly higher than the increases up to now. And this is essentially a consequence of the strategic planning, where we now have specific projects to spend this money on. There's thought put into how exactly we're going to spend this money. But very important here is to look at, this is just one of our biggest areas of costs that will increase going forward is fees going to lawyers and economic consultants. This these are costs incurred once we've completed our investigation and this case is now in the realm of a hearing. In other words, it's either at the tribunal or in any of the other courts, depending on what the matter is. This costs us, the vast majority of cases we have, say in mergers, let's talk about mergers for a moment. The vast majority of cases we have in mergers are uncontested mergers. We take a decision to allow the merger and that's the end of it. We deal with it for a very short period of time. But if a merger is contested, in other words, supposing we prohibit the merger or we place conditions on this merger before it can be implemented, and the parties don't agree with us, or supposing the tribunal takes an adverse decision where it prohibits the merger and it has to go on appeal, those cases can cost us an enormous amount of money. If you look at like the Telkom BCX merger, for example, it cost the commission just to run that case more than R1.5 million, just in lawyer and consultant fees. The Netcare CHG merger was a similar amount, was above R1.5 million, just one case. So while the majority of the cases don't cost us a lot in terms of this kind of expenditure, it just takes 1, 2, 3, 4 cases to kind of deplete your budget on a contested merger. Just a simple kind of procedural case, somebody taking a procedural point, not relating to the kind of content matter. Us kind of fighting a case like that can cost us up to R750,000 just in legal fees. A prohibited practice case can cost you in excess of R2 million per case. So the legal fees is by far going to be the biggest. As our work increases, as more cases mature and reach adjudicative bodies, in particular the tribunal, but even beyond that, the big cost going forward for us is going to be legals and consultants costs. One of the difficulties we have here is that it is really difficult for us to predict. We can take calculated guesses, but you can't exactly predict how many contested mergers you're going to have in the next year. You can't even predict, you can't predict how the parties are going to behave when you refer a restrictive practice case. If parties have an incentive to frustrate the process by taking legal points and taking it to different courts and that can be extremely that can cost a lot. So we anticipate that this is an area in particular where our costs will increase. Just to look at the graph here that looks at the trend of divisional expenditure over time, and I think the only kind of really significant thing here is to say that you'll notice that it's in the area of enforcement and it's in the area of our policy and research that you'll find the steepest curves going forward. In other words, going forward, we're going to put more resources into those two areas as opposed to the other areas. Okay, just to kind of explain here that the corporate services amounts are higher because they include all the overall costs of running the organization. Okay, now this is also a very important graph because there's something that needs to be explained here in some amount of detail. You see here that our income, we get the competition authorities get their income from two sources. Firstly, there's all the filing fees. When parties need a merger approved and they notify us of that merger, they pay a filing fee. Okay? We retain that money, unlike the fines. The fines we don't retain. The fines, if somebody gets fined, that money goes straight to the DTI, to Treasury. But the filing fee, we retain that money, and the DTI tops it up, depending on what our budget submission is. Okay? And you'll see here, the brown sections on the top is how much the DTI has topped up, and the green, the olive green sections below are our income from filing fees. Now, you'll notice in this graph that the olive green section falls quite dramatically from 2007-8 to 2008-9, which means that going forward, DTI is going to be, in the graph shows that DTI will be paying a larger proportion of our total income, contributing a larger proportion to that. And the reason for this is that we have in place now plans to increase the merger thresholds. This is, just to explain what that means, merger thresholds are determined, are set in order to determine whether a transaction is notifiable or not. So you have a threshold of annual turnover and asset value, and beyond that, beyond the first threshold, there's two thresholds. There's a threshold that define what is a large, intermediate, or small merger, and beyond those thresholds, those transactions are notifiable, but below the lower threshold, the parties don't have to notify those transactions. If we increase the threshold, fewer transactions are going to be notifiable. Okay, we haven't increased the thresholds for merger notifiability since the start of these organizations, since the start of the organization, and of course, you know, the cost of everything and the cost of money has come down, the cost of everything else has gone up. So using CPI and market capitalization of the JSE, we've calculated what we calculated the new thresholds based on increases in those indicators. So what it's going to mean is that we're going to get less income from filing fees, and DTI is going to have to increase their contribution to our budget going forward. And just to say, here I explained earlier the kind of difficulties that we have in making very accurate predictions. It's very hard to know how many mergers are there going to be in this economy in the next year. It's very hard to know, how many kind of cases will be contested by parties. And for last year, for example, we had many, many more mergers than we predicted there would be. So this last year we've had more filing fees than we predicted that we would have had. So and this last graph is essentially to just show that one of the things that's happened in the organization over time is that we've consistently accumulated surpluses which we've taken on to the next year. And this graph just shows the relative amounts of the surpluses compared to the amount of actual income we've got. I'd like to conclude now just to say that the bottom line of everything I've said so far, the message here is that what the Competition Commission will do in the next period is, firstly, it will step up its activity quite considerably. We'll see more investigations and more prosecutions. we'll see more of the market inquiry kind of research that that kind of informs good decision making in the organization, and we'll see more advocacy work in the, from the competition authorities. In order to sustain, to support and sustain all this work, we would have to re-look at the structure and see, ensure that the structure of the organization is effective, both in terms of improving current management and communication, but also in terms of what additional resources and additional units you need to add to the structure in order to do all the work we intend to do. And secondly, to develop our knowledge management system so that we have good information to enable good decisions. And then the third big issue is that we will develop, is our commitment to develop the skills within the organization to incentivize staff to deal with the issues around salaries and to put into place good training and development strategies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Could we take the next presentation, competition tribunal, and thereafter we'll...
I'm asked Chan to work the slides for me. He knows our technology. I'll be very much briefer than Shan. I think that you all appreciate that we're an unusual body in the DTI family of institutions, and that we are purely a decision making body. We're purely an adjudicative body, effectively a court, which makes us, in some sense, quite a powerful organisation. But it also means that we have absolutely no control over what our workflow is, or what our work content is. We are entirely dependent upon what others, mostly but not exclusively, the Competition Commission, places before us, which, as I've explained to you as I go along, gives us not only little ability to predict what our workflow is, obviously gives us even less ability than the Commission has to predict accurately what our budgetary requirements are going to be, because we are, our demand, in fact, is derived from the activities of other organizations. But let me just take you through a very brief presentation, much of which many of you will be familiar with. There are quite a few people here who are sort of veterans of the Competition Act, and so you will know quite easily what I'm talking about. Those are the members of the tribunal. Three of those members, Vuyiseni Madlanga, Tandi Olane, Lawrence Rayburn, expire at the end of March, and all three have been reappointed for a second five-year term by Cabinet. In addition, we've had one additional member appointed, Dr. Nicholas Aron, an economist from Stellenbosch University. So we have a full complement of 10 members plus the chairperson, which is the full complement allowed to us by the Act. Of those members, 8 are lawyers or have legal training, and 3 are economists. An ideal balance would probably be 7-4, but we have a balance of 8-3. And then again, of those 11 people, 3 are full-time. That's myself, who chairs the tribunal, and Norman Manoyam and Yasmin Karim are full-time members of the tribunal. All the others are part-time members of the tribunal. And again, it is very difficult to get that particular balance right. At the moment, we probably have fewer full-time members than we should have, but there are times when three is adequate. I haven't got a slide on the staff, but I'll just speak briefly to that as well. We have a very small staff of 15 people, organized into 3 divisions: the Corporate Services Division, which is the support division; the Research Division, which is small research division that assists the panel in the adjudication of cases, and then the registry, which is really the interface between the tribunal and the public. Our turnover has been in the past relatively low, but it's starting, I have to say, to increase somewhat, because like the commission, we are highly exposed to the public, and particularly we are highly exposed to law firms and economic consultancies. Our staff are very exposed to them, to the work that they do. And it's not long before affected staff members are recognized and picked off by the private sector, and to some extent the public sector as well. I mean, in certain instances, I'm pleased to say that some of our staff members, not least of all Shan and Tulani, both of whom worked at the tribunal at some stage, have now both gone to the commission. And that's in some sense a particular pleasure for us. And I hope that when they're old and wise like myself, they'll come back to the tribunal as tribunal members. But very often we find quite junior commission people and junior tribunal researchers appearing before us as lowly lawyers within very big law firms or very big economic consultancies, often earning considerably more than the people that they appear before. And so this is a problem in turnover. And it's a problem that can partly be limited by a more realistic salary arrangement. But I don't think that we will ever compete with the private sector on salaries. And I don't think that should be our objective. I think that what our objective is, speaking for the tribunal, is to make the tribunal such an attractive place to work at that we continually attract new people into our ranks. And I have started to notice that at the junior level, particularly at the researchers level, we are starting to attract people even from the private sector, young lawyers and young economists, particularly young lawyers from the private sector, who have come to realize that to have a 3-year stint at the competition tribunal on their CV is a very good investment for going back into the private sector and earning even more than they would have earned had they gone there initially. And I'm not really resentful of that fact. I want people to believe that the competition tribunal is a place that they can come and learn something at. But it is sometimes disheartening to invest a lot in training and staff development only to find them very easily picked off by the private sector. You see the mandate of the tribunal there. And what we do effectively is that in respect of mergers, we are the decision makers in the case of mergers, large mergers, mergers above a particular threshold, and we act on a recommendation placed before us by the commission, and we then hold a hearing and we decide the outcome of the merger, either to prohibit the merger or to allow the merger or to allow the merger with conditions. And then in respect of intermediate mergers, mergers that fall below a certain threshold, the commission decides those mergers, and in very rare instances where the commission's decision is appealed, it's appealed to us. In respect of anti-competitive practices, these are both horizontal practices like cartels and vertical practices like abuse of dominance. We adjudicate those complaints referrals that once again are usually placed before us by the commission, but in instances where the commission declines to prosecute a particular complaint because it believes that it's not well founded or because it's not a priority for the commission, these complaints may be brought to us by private parties, and we do hear some important cases, maybe one of the most important cases we've heard in recent years. The Mittal Harmony case was brought to us by a private party on the Gold. And then we adjudicate interim relief applications, which are always brought by private parties, never by the commission. And we very rarely, in fact, I'm not even certain we've ever heard an appeal on an exemption, but that is within our jurisdiction. Now, that's a slide that's difficult to read, but these are the number of cases that have appeared before us in the 11 months between the 1st of April 2007 and the end of February 2008. And you'll see there we've heard 82 mergers. Shan explained that most mergers, the vast majority of mergers, are quite uncontroversial, but we nevertheless hear them, read a vast amount of paper that is submitted to us, and write a decision in respect of every merger that comes before us. but some of them can be heard in a very, very short time. Others that are contested take up considerably more resources and considerably more time. So in this period, we've heard 82 large mergers. We've heard one appeal from a decision by the tribunal that gave an intermediate merger. We've heard 31 procedural cases, and those vary hugely. They may be an application by a party to participate in a merger hearing, to intervene in a merger hearing. They may be challenges to procedures that the Commission have used. We've heard 31 of those cases, and they tend to be often quite lengthy and complex cases. We've heard 8 complaints submitted by the Commission, and though that sounds small, these are very large cases that take up a considerable amount of hearing time often, unless they are settled. And we have heard 2 cases submitted to us by private complainants, one of which was the Harmony Goldfields Mittal Steel case that probably absorbed something of the nature of, I think, 40 hearing days and resulted in the filing of more than 1.5 million pages of evidence. And so these cases are huge cases when they come before us. And we've heard 1 interim relief application in that period. So we've sat for a total of 129 days in the 11-month period. Now, if you think that there are only probably about 180, 190 working days in that period, our ratio of hearing days to working days is very high.
Yeah.
When you consider the number of the amount of reading and the amount of writing and the amount of preparation that has to go into each of the hearings, it is a very high ratio, but that's what it is. On the question of strategic planning, as I explained to you at the beginning, and I won't take any time over this, we don't really have the ability to plan strategically because we hear whatever is placed before us. As an adjudicative body, we can't decide that we are going to go after a particular sector of the economy. We can only go after whatever is placed before us, and we then have to fairly and objectively decide whether the institution or the person who places something before us is right or is wrong. So our caseload is entirely determined by complaint referrals and notified mergers. We do, however, if you can go to the next slide, we do, however, have a number of objectives, and I think that those are probably not appropriately called strategic objectives, but more, if you like, operational objectives. And they're divided into 3 major categories. And the first is policy and legislation, the second is enforcement and compliance, and the third is education and awareness. And our activities and we have identified activities and outputs for each category, and we have possibly assigned performance indicators and targets to each of those outputs. And these are very importantly for us used not only in our reporting to institutions like yourself and the DTI, but also in our performance reviews of each staff member. So our operational objectives are 7 in nature. The first is to ensure timeliest decisions of a high caliber. We work to very, very strict time frames, particularly where mergers are concerned. And we have a commitment, in fact, we have a legal obligation to produce our decisions within the statutory time frames, which sometimes makes work very, very hectic. Our work is very much like a roller coaster. Sometimes you can come around to the office and imagine we do nothing. On other occasions, we're just completely over our head when we have to finish the drafting of a particular complex merger decision in the 30 days that is allowed to us to do that. So we want to ensure that our decisions are brought out timelessly and that they are of a high caliber. I'm pleased to say that our decisions are starting to be referred to even in international courts and international competition conferences, and so I'm persuaded that our decisions are of a caliber that is recognize to be reasonably high. We want to ensure compliance with relevant legislation. I don't know how much you appreciate how difficult it is for a small organization like ourselves to ensure compliance with the legislation that we have to ensure compliance with, like the PFMA, but not only the PFMA. And a very large part of the activities of one of our senior managers is taken up only with ensuring compliance with relevant legislation, but I'm pleased to say that we've never been qualified for not complying with the legislation. To encourage effective internal and external communication. I should say about external communication that the two most important instruments of that are firstly our website, which is a very widely used website and which contains all of our decisions. So every single decision that we take is immediately placed on our website. And for those of you who need to know about a particular industry or particular sector of the economy, it's a very useful resource. I'm told that it has a very effective search capability, and so it would be, you know, not only for those who are interested in competition matters, but simply those who are interested in what is going on in a particular sector, it would be a very good resource. And then I think the other effective external communication is the public nature of our hearings. It really sometimes is very gratifying to see a corporate sector in South Africa, which I think has been notoriously secretive in the past, having to come before a public body and explain itself and explain its actions in the public eye. Occasionally there are confidential matters, and occasionally we have to go into camera to protect business secrets, but those are the exception rather than the rule. And I think that I sometimes think that more than our decisions, the simple fact that we allow as much sunlight to penetrate into places that were as dark as they were before has been in many ways the most effective part of our activity. We attempt through our public exposure to maintain a good corporate image and reputation, and we manage to do so in spite of the ill temper of the chairperson of the Competition Tribunal occasionally. I think we do maintain a good corporate image and reputation. We try to provide an efficient, competent and speedy service to the public, and again we have ways of measuring this. Our registry is the pivotal institution in that respect. It's the part of the institution that receives filings from commission or from the public. We attempt to inculcate what we've called an appropriate value system or proper value system. We have a code of ethics that the Competition Tribunal members are expected to adhere to. They are required to regularly declare their interests, because there is a possibility, particularly with respect to the part-timers working in law practices and other places, there is potential of conflicts of interest, and we manage those conflicts of interest rather than try and eliminate them, and we've managed to manage them effectively. Many of you would have seen me a couple of weeks ago appearing before you for the IBC, and that to some extent represents a conflict for me which has to be managed from time to time. But we've managed those conflicts very effectively through our code of practice and through our declaration of interest. And above all, as an adjudicative body, we have to be seen to be fair, objective, and independent. And even though, you know, these are my sort of old friends and comrades, many of whom worked with me in the Competition Tribunal, they now are simply just another institution that is appearing before me, and very often we are obliged to take decisions that they don't like, and I think that we do take decisions sometimes that they don't like. And I'm sure sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong, but we get to take the decision.
That's important.
The financial management, we're a small organization, so not in aggregate numbers a very high budget organization. You see there our budget, like the commission, a certain amount of that is received via filing fees, and a certain, then there's a top up from the DTI. The proposed change in the merger thresholds and filing fees means that the tribunal will, at least over the next 2 to 3 years, rely more heavily on funding from the DTI. My experience is that in about 2 to 3 years' time, that will again correct itself with inflation, as we get to hear more mergers. But when the filing thresholds change, immediately there will be something of a drop-off in the number of mergers that are notified, and therefore in the filing fees. And so we almost certainly will have to request an adjustment in the medium-term expenditure framework, and in the next several years, somewhat larger grants going forward. That is a breakdown of our budget allocation, a large proportion of which goes to staff costs. We spend a lot on training. As I said earlier, I think that one thing that we can offer our members, we're a very small and we're a very flat organization, so there's not a lot of room for promotion and expansion within the organization. And one thing that I feel that we can offer is training opportunities that will enable people to go out into other institutions when they have risen and can rise no further in our institution. And as I say, mostly we hope that they go to institutions like the Competition Commission or other regulators, but sometimes they do indeed go to the private sector, and sometimes they go to a shared set of regulators elsewhere. We too have to maintain a high budget for professional services. Although we're not a litigating body like, we're not a prosecuting authority like the Commission is, we very often have to respond to litigation. And so we have to maintain a fairly high budget, which we mostly is mostly in excess of what is required. It's the one area in which we underspend our budget on a fairly regular basis. But if we were caught in a situation where we were unable to respond to litigation, the consequences may be quite severe, so we have to maintain a reasonable budget for that. And then the one but last slide, which is going to this, and I mean there again is a breakdown of our financial management. You'll see the last bullet point there says that we last year spent 83% of our budget, and that principally arises from our inability to predict how much we are going to use in need required professional fees each year. And as you'll see, something that I've emphasized already in the third bullet point, that because we are a reactive organization, it is very difficult to predict the number of cases that will be heard annually, and our expenditure is directly related to the number of cases that we hear, particularly when we have to use part-time members and then pay them a daily fee for appearing as part-time members of the Commission. Our budget, our expenditure is directly related to the number of days they have to sit there. And where, for example, the full-time members or two of the full-time members get tied up for 30, 40 days on one case, the upshot of that is that we have to use the part-time members more, and so our budget changes. I would like to, while I'm mentioning that, really like to pay tribute to our part-time members. Our vice chair, Varun Marani, is probably well known to all of you, and it's often not appreciated about them, although they receive a daily fee that I'm pleased to say that many of you would consider generous. Compared to the many of them are senior advocates or senior economists, and compared to those what their colleagues who are appearing before us are earning, they are their fees from the tribunal are very, very small indeed. And because they are members of the tribunal, they are precluded from appearing before us. And so they really have, you know, are providing a public service that is absolutely invaluable to us. And we continue, even though the large bulk of the work is taken on by the full-time members, their insights and their contribution and their participation in the tribunal are really very significant. There is, just as the final slide, our five-year budget, like everything else, is going up sort of on a fairly regular kind of basis. Our filing fee income sort of flattens out because of the predicted increase in merger thresholds, but it starts to increase again after that. And so thank you for the opportunity to. I'll say just maybe one more thing that I don't have a slide on, but in the last period, we've had a number of interesting cases. And just to give you a flavor of what those are, many of these may be cases that you've read about. The one of those highly publicized was the excessive steel pricing case, which will go on appeal in, I think, September this year, where we found Mittal Steel had contravened the Competition Act by pricing excessively. It's a very complex decision, but it's an interesting decision. And again, for those of you who are interested in how the steel industry works, it's, I think, worth a read. Their Mittal were fined 691,800,000 rand. Now, many people think about our fines. These are like telephone number size fines, and they are very much larger than I think the society is used to hearing corporate fines. But the wisdom and the learning in competition practice, in competition regulation, is the size of the fine very, very rarely equates to the size of the profits derived from the activity. And so even though these fines sound very high, the amount of profit that is derived from the contravention for which corporates are fined, particularly in the case of cartels, is in fact usually considerably larger. We have heard a number of interesting cartel cases. The Brent case, which you all know about, was settled. I want to share with Chan our pleasure at having before us in that hearing members of the public, consumers, unions, human rights bodies. There are a number of other cartel cases that are being placed before us that have not been settled, and I don't know what the outcome of those will be, but there are a number of interesting cartel cases in the milk industry and scrap metal industry that are currently before us. We are dealing with a very interesting case at the moment in an industry that I'm sure not many of you, with the exception of Shad, will feel too sympathetic towards, but in the case of cigarette distribution, we have a very, very large case that even if you are not particularly interested in the interests of cigarette consumers, is going to have a very important impact on practices between supermarkets and retailers on the one hand and manufacturers on the other hand that may have implications that reach far beyond the cigarette industry. And then we have done a number of interesting mergers, probably the most highly publicized of which was the Telkom-BCX merger, where in line with the Commission's recommendation in that instance, we prohibited a proposed acquisition by Telkom of the country's biggest IT company. There are a number of other mergers that we've heard that we've imposed conditions on with a variety of sorts. And then, lastly, one of our most interesting decisions was released only a week or two ago, was a decision that we took where the Commission had agreed to, the Commission and the Netcare Hospital Group had agreed to a fine of 6 million rand that they put before us in the form of a consent order. Now, normally, in 99 cases out of 100, we would defer to the Commission's decision to agree a consent order because we want to encourage that to happen. In this instance, the panel of the tribunal decided that the fine was too low, in fact. And the facts of that case are interesting, which I can go into. I wasn't on the panel, but to the extent that I'm familiar with them, I think I am familiar with them. But those are amongst the more interesting cases that we've had over the last while. Thank you.
Mr. Lewis, thank you very much. I'll now avail the opportunity to members for comments, questions, clarification. I had Mr. Labuschagne first. Comrade Nantuli. Comrade Dali. Mr. Lavaskarnica.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry for coming late, but as you know, there was a lot of traffic on the roads today.
I did apologize on your behalf.
Thank you again, Mr. Romberitz, for your eloquent exposition. I just have one question. When you talk about building strategic alliances, you mentioned government and you mentioned trade unions. I didn't seem to hear you mention business. And after all, those are the guys that are most probably always... Would that be because they're usually the culprits, therefore you don't want to build a strategic alliance? If you just... couple on that, I think that's... Actually, the only one I have for you, for the Competition Tribunal. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Could we be furnished with the CVs of your panel? You know, just for our own background, so it's just not a name. It would be interesting, I would, if that's possible. Again, having... just a little clarification, but I understand that is there, when you say appeal court, would this be appeals from the decisions of the tribunal to the High Court of South Africa, you know, for people who are not happy with your decisions, and therefore do you then, I assume you then have to appoint counsel because you're one of the parties, in a sense, to the higher appeal. Would the appeal be by the aggrieved party? You know, normally if two people lose, A loses to B, A then, you know, takes his legal team and appeals all the way up until they run out of money or can't go any further. In a case like this, is it more in a sense that there's only an A before the tribunal, and therefore the tribunal is then, in a sense, the respondent? If I could just get a little clarity on that, and that's all from my side. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Lavaskarni. Men, Judy?
Yabonga, Shado. Who Competition Commission, it's a pity you don't have the AMA pages, but on the slide, the increased staff morale and motivation, you talked about approving of market-related salaries in keeping with the market. And you also talk about strengthening training and staff development. Now, when you talked about that, you said the graduate training program that you conduct in the organization. You said sometimes those students leave after training. Don't you have a way of keeping those students with you after training? Because you cannot train people just for them to leave, to be taken by other people when you have used the department's money. My second question is in relation with the banks. I think you have indicated that you're looking at bank charges, interest rates, ATM fees, cost of transactions, etc. Now, what happens after you have investigated and you know about all this? But even after all the investigations that are done, the banks continue as business as usual. Nothing is happening. We are still charged. The charges are still the same. What is the purpose of investigating if there will be no changes? Because this affects the consumer. The same applies in the property industry. The property industry has become the most expensive industry in South Africa. And there's a lot of unfairness in this industry. And all the property agents are doing the same thing. You know, selling a house in the township and selling the same house in the city, you get different prices. The house in the township is very cheap and the house in the city is very expensive. It's worse even in the rural areas. The same house in the rural areas is bought next to nothing. Now, I don't know what is your thinking as the Competition Commission along in relation to this property agent thing. I leave the penalties because I wanted to know what is done if the penalties are paid. Yes, answered me on that one. Coming to the to Tiger Brand. I don't know whether in protecting the consumer, after the investigation and after a penalty has been paid, and what happens again is the same as what I've said with the banks. People are the ones that are paying that money. Because after that, bread went up. If you look at the price of brown bread, it's now at about 7.50, if I'm not right. Wrong. Yes, 7.50. Now, if the loaf of bread is 7.50, Umantuli is paying 7.60 for a loaf of brown bread. And Umamkize Lapa Emadubaduba is also paying 7.50 for a loaf of brown bread. Umantuli is working here in Parliament earning a salary. Umamkize is not working. And there's nowhere where Umamkize can get work. Umamkize depends on the child grant or on the pension grant of her mother. But they are all paying the same amount of money for a loaf of brown bread. Now, I don't know whether to say, does the Competition Commission have some teeth to fight things like this? Because in real terms, consumers are suffering. The penalty that the firms are paying will then be paid by the consumers in turn. So how do we deal with that to make sure that the consumers don't carry the burden in the future? And good tribunal. Again, it's in Yabonga to Ubuchi. This was Nigeza, the presentation. Do you want me to interpret that?
It's prosastory.
Yeah, it's prosastory from Dagama. Now, it's almost the same question because I was going to ask you, Ubuchi, how do you protect yourself from being drained by the market of your members since you are exposed to the public and the law firms outside there? How do you then protect yourself from that? Because you cannot keep on training people, and you train a person, Manduli comes and take the person, you train others, Manduli comes. How do you protect yourself in that? You also indicated that you don't control, you don't have control over the number and types of cases brought before the tribunal. Who controls that? If you can just okay. Yeah, I think I can stop on that part.
Mentally, Baba Jasper.
Yes, thank you, Justin. And also thank you to the presenters for their presentation. Firstly, from the competition, in terms of your strategic priority, bullet point number four. Establish the Commission as a center of information, common knowledge and expertise. I want to link that with the retention of staff. How are you intending to do that? Because with this problem of the staff turnover. How are you going to do that? I want just you to link in your answer with that particular issue. The next question will be on terms of the increased staff morale and motivation, which I think link with the previous question. Then steps to accomplish the I think there's a point, bullet point number two, then the dash two there, to review HR policy. I'm sure you have identified some loopholes. What are those loopholes that you have identified in order for you to make sure that there was a need of the reviewer? And the other issue, I think it was raised by the complete tribunal that you are not going to, of course, compete in the private sector. I'm sure you link with this one, how you intend to do those parts. Issue. Commission's approach and methodology, impact on poor consumers. Maybe you need just a little elaborate for us on this particular issue, just a little bit in terms of that particular issue. The next one, priority sector. I'll concentrate, I think, on two, bullet point number two and bullet number three. New infrastructure construction, including building ready. You see, in terms of this one, I'd like to check whether for the list of these issues in relation to this competition and cartels and all those things. Start from bullet point number two, in terms of your refer to the cement and steel. I think this was the first time that this comes before us in relation to the cost, in particular on the cement and steel, those two areas. If I don't know that whether I mean because of this 2010, then the construction industry is really making sure that it milks as much as they can. Because the cement, of course, is scarce within the country itself. I'm sure they are importing from China and India and I don't know whether other countries. One is you can just elaborate for us whether you maybe see something that is taking place in that particular area. In terms of the agro-processing and specifically food, I think Comrade Mantul has raised special tiger brands that I think has been mentioned here. The issue that I want to take further there, it's in relation of the, I'll come back to the committee tribunal, I'm also on part of that one. But after the fine has been, you see, handed down, whatever case may be, now the intendance is this, that they are passing that cost to consumers. You know, how can you make sure that money is plowed back to those that have been taken from? was in various areas, not only in terms of your files and other sort of departments, to find that these monies are recouped from certain individuals or companies, and they're not plowed back to where they're supposed to go to. Either these monies, they go to Treasury, and the Treasury decides how to redirect these funds. And the Treasury, in most cases, is not really sympathetic to the public wallet. I can tell you that. Treasury is not at all. They're just looking for money, nothing else. So I don't know in terms of your mechanism to make sure that the poor forests are benefiting. Taking further comment, Matthew is right. You know, 2 weeks ago, the local brown bread was 650. The following week was 750. I was talking to some of the consumers even now, that some of the retailers, that they received a letter from SAFCO, so that is a group that is managing this guy. They received a letter that is going to increase from that 750, it's going to 850 very soon. You see? Very soon. So it therefore means that whatever you do, whatever fines you give them, they just mind and say, no, fine. They know that how they're going to recoup that one. In the next 2 weeks, it's going to be 850. Maybe before the end of next, let's say June or July, it's going to be 10 rand. What do you think about it? Because it doesn't make sense. Really doesn't make sense. I think I've got list of in terms of under that particular issue. I think I've dealt with the bread, milk industry, cement, steel, I've dealt with fertilizer. And I was told by some of these cooperatives, the NPG in particular, upgrade, that the cement in the next season is going to go up with between 50 and 60%. The farmers are not going to afford, I can tell you now. I can tell you right now. Maybe there's something that's taking place under the in terms of the fertilizer there. I'm sure Comrade Mantle have dealt with the banking sector. The red meat. I don't know what's going on there also. Because the red meat is no longer luxury, if I may say so. These people cannot afford red meat at all. Though it will have their own repercussions one way or another, I don't know. But these are the areas which really are raising serious problems, particularly in the agricultural sector. One can just leave it, say something about that. In particular, it's another reference to, because agriculture is a backbone of any country. But if the fertilizer, you can't afford to buy a fertilizer, 50 kgs, white farmers, you know better than me. You see, it's terrible, really terrible. If I may, okay, move that, the question of the align organizational structure to strategic priorities, clarify roles and responsibilities. I'm sure even there, we have identified some problems. I don't know whether I will call it as a mismatch or whatever case it is, because when you begin to identify roles as if there were no clarity in terms of who's supposed to do what. This can give you educated on that particular one. Advocacy and communication. Give voice to consumers and civil society. How? Because I may not say that maybe you're not known, but it is maybe clear that you are not known in a number of areas. You only be known when you have got big cases, like the Tiger Brand and others. Otherwise, you are not known by the ordinary consumer. That they can complain to you to say, hey, this thing that we have identified. And in terms of that, I just want to also check in terms of your, maybe the question will come later, in terms of the research, because your researchers are supposed to pick this thing up. I don't know whether they are picking those things up in terms of, I just want to know in terms of how are you intending to do that, and how far can you go in terms of making sure that there's that transparency that you're referred to. Convention structure, legal and there's a cost. Let me quickly go to the legal and consultant cost. You also told us that most of your budget goes to that item. Legal, I may understand, but the consultant, I've got a problem with government in general. But most of the government officials, I always call them functionaries, sometimes they tend to be lazy. And then the work that's supposed to be done by them, done by consultants. When I say in general, all spheres inside, particularly the most culprit is local government in this case of consultants. That you find that the staff or officials or functionaries will come and present you a closing presentation. It's not done by them. He can't be consulted. There's a problem in terms of consultants in government generally. That the usage of consultants is really, really out of hand. Out of hand, completely out of hand. I don't think just a bit, So the, I think, let me quickly go to tribunal and leave the to create surplus. Now let me leave the surplus, because I thought I'm going to answer around surplus. Let me leave that one for maybe for other my colleagues. Competition tribunal. Let me come back to that one. The question of your staff. You said you will prefer 7-4. If I understood you correctly, I wanted to check in terms of the full time. But I thought that the lawyers, of course, are important. Also, your economy. I'll assume that one or two supposed to be full time as an economist in relation to the area of cooperation that you are involved in. The next one, I think, if you can also respond in relation to the list that I gave to the competition, because I also have the same list for yourself. Maybe you can also elaborate in terms of that. I'm not going to repeat that for the question of time. The other issue that I want to share with yourself, the slide that you didn't have, but you just spoke to that particular slide. Staff of 15 people. Again, the question of the research division. I want to know how big your research division is. Because, as you have correctly said, that some of your staff, they appear before the guys who are well paid, which needs a lot of research, a lot of research. That area is an area which I thought is supposed to be part of your core business. You can at least figure out what registry is not much, but there are just registered cases that have been filed as such. But one question of the research division. I just want to check in terms of. You can elaborate for us on that one. You have referred to cases before the tribunal. You referred to commission complaints by Commission 8. I just want to check in terms of this one. I'm sure the competition also referred, or you spoke about the consent order. I wonder if, in terms of this, is no mechanism, what you call the mediation, that the two parties can be mediated to reduce the cost. If is there any such sort of area that needs to be looked at or has been looked at in terms of making sure that every case is not always argued before yourself. The other issue in terms of your strategic objective, Roman figure number 2, enforcement and compliance. I want to link this compliance and enforcement to the Tiger Brand again to say, how do you enforce your judgment? And also, in terms of making sure that they are complying accordingly and they are not doing what we are saying they are doing now, in terms of passing that to the people that you are supposed to protect. And make sure, if that is the case, in terms of the monitoring mechanism, in terms of their compliance, can you please elaborate in terms of that, you know? Because I think I've already mentioned, I don't want to repeat that, but the tendency that we are seeing in terms of that particular one. The other issue in terms of your financial management. See, if I'm looking at this, break 1 to 2, 3, and 4, if my mathematics is right, it seems to me 73.5%, 45%, the cost of these three items. I've also excluded the recruitment, break point number 4, 5, I've excluded that one, 0.36. Then, which means, I come back to the issue that has been raised in the other areas, that the personnel is really, in terms of all other budgets, it's a huge cost. Sometimes it's not a core business of any institution, but find that the personnel is taking chunk of your budget. So if my mathematics is wrong, I'll just quickly add the 73.45%, only those three items. So it means they're taking off all your budget. Same applying to the last grade, point of the financial management again, which is 2006-2007, spent 83.62%. I may claim that is understanding. This can easily elaborate as in terms of that, what is the cost of that, because once you want more money, and you can't spend the money that you have in your kit, I may not give you more money, because you can't spend money. Why should I give you more money? This can easily elaborate to that, you see, because in terms of your itemized items there, Maybe the researchers I referred to on the competition, which comes also back to you, that you also elaborate on that one. Maybe it's not indicated, but it's part of, maybe part of the personnel, I assume. But I thought maybe it should be a standalone item so that we can understand the impact that might have in terms of your operation. I thought, Chairperson, I can end there, but the documentation that you referred to, mine will be interested. I like reading some of these issues. But maybe I'll check with the functionaries in the committee that may help me, such as in other people, just to get hold of you so that I can get reading some of these cases that you have referred. Your steel price cases, your checker brand cases, your cigarette distribution that you have referred it to, and the cartel cases in general, you mean first method. Those are the issues that you have referred to. Maybe one to check with the function is here. Thanks very much, Chairman.
Comrade, kindly thanks for the comments and all the questions. I must just say that when you are asking, saying that what farmers could help you with the price of manure, and you are looking at Dr. Rabi and Mr. Labuskaya, they both looked very perplexed. It was the last time I knew that Dr. Rabi, if he farms, he farms in economic ideas. And Mr. Labuskaya, if he farms in legal ideas. So it might also be creatively interpreted as an area of farming. And immediately after your comment, they went to get something to eat. I don't want to take that as logical conclusion as to what you derive from that. That has meant, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe the first thing that I must actually raise is that I think we need to be a bit sensitive. I know we always agree in the committee about many issues, but for the request that we must actually call for people's CVs, I think it is not really, I don't know what to call it, it's not necessary, yes, not necessary. Because we would do so if perhaps we were interviewing people, you know, for a particular post and so on. So I think we must be sensitive about those things. The question that goes to both the tribunal and the commission is about the measures and acquisitions. Perhaps if they can say something about that, you know, are they good for the economy or bad for the economy? And what drives these acquisitions and measures? Yeah, and would it be those big companies that want to the measures to happen, the smaller companies? Those that are equal in size, or would it be the smaller companies that want measures? So just clarify that to us. The other questions from the commission around advocacy. And I think I agree with other members to say that I don't think that the commission and the tribunal are well known by the people out there. Are not well known. I think, I don't know how, or what is it that could do about this. When you say you ensure effective advocacy and communication, is it communication to just the big guys, big players in the industry and other law firms and other affluent people? Or how far do you go to the rank and file? I think even at the level of unions, I don't know how do they communicate with the lower structures. because I don't think that the commission and the tribunal are well known. Do you perhaps have a relationship with CDWs, community workers, development workers, community development workers, new area where government is investing a lot of money, I believe, training and so on, and the intention is that these people that are employed at that level within the community development workers are going to be, you know, an extension of government services and so on and information. So do you relate to them? The banks, that question needs a lot to be, you know, explored. Whether, you know, there's progress, you know, they're still actually doing their cartel activities. You know, we had even in the previous presentations that there's something that you did. What progress? When are they going to stop the malpractices that they're engaged in? Are you going to be part of the conference that is coming, I think, next week, Financial Sector Coalition Conference? I think Sparks are going to fly there about the benefits special. And what role are you going to play there if you are going to participate in that one? The question around bid rigging is a big problem, you know, for the country. It's a big problem. Public Service Commission has complained a lot about this issue, Chair. A lot, in that, you know, since civil servants, public servants are actually actively involved in this bid rigging. Actively involved in the manner that even other private sector companies are complaining, in that they would, even if one company is bidding, submitting documents, they would actually pass on those documents to other bidders. You know, is there something that you're doing about this, and what is it? To what extent are you working on curbing this malpractice?
I think I'm done with the commission.
Three full-time members of the tribunal, and the rest are part-time. What are the challenges do you come across because of that? If fewer people are part-time, great majority are the challenges, or you don't actually experience any problems with regard to that? Also, you indicated that you also appear for IDC, which, and we have indicated that this type, the work of the tribunal is very, very it's a busy tribunal, you know, the work that you are doing there, quite, you know, demanding on you and other members. That then, DTI also deploys you on this IDC. How do you actually manage? Because I must say that, Chair, we actually have raised this concern to the DTI that, you know, they are double parking or double dipping or people, you know. One person who runs an important institution goes to another institution, sits on the board, etc., etc. And we said, we don't know why this happened, because I think it places more burden on individuals and actually divert their attention, you know, their focus attention in the institution that they run. We have raised that with them. I don't know whether you are in, you do encounter problems with regard to that. You say that you would want, or you are working towards ensuring that the tribunal becomes an attractive place to work in, to avert this turnover, and to attract more people to the tribunal. Well, what is it exactly that you do? So that we understand and we can learn, and other institutions can learn from you, even the commission, you know, to attract a lot of people even from the private sector and other places. Thank you, sir.
Comrade Hasmini, thanks. The next is Comrade Denny. But just before you, Comrade Denny, I think the issue of CVs, Comrade Hasmin, if I understood Mr. Labiskakni correct, I don't think it's a sensitive issue, in the sense that the members of the board, their CVs are public knowledge. They are published there, anybody can look as to what their qualifications. So in us doing our work, I would think that any member would be entitled to us to look at Moirani's CV. He's a top lawyer in the country and what have you. So I look at it from that perspective. There are lawyers, there are economists. What's the brief of this committee? So we should enable any member of the committee to be able to ask for such information. It's almost in my mind the same like your CVs, those of members of parliament, which has just been put on a parliamentary website. I might not like to look at my CV every day, but any member of the public can just punch in there and say, Parliament, that fellow who chairs trade and industry today, where does he come from? Then they have access to this information. So I just thought very broadly, that's the context.
Yeah. Would it not be advisable then, Chair, for one to go straight to the website rather than actually requesting the CV from the institutions?
No. That announcement, we are just going into details there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the authority is here, you can just ask them directly. There's no problem with that. I don't think they would object, but they can answer for themselves. It has happened in the past that we have had people before us, and where we request for information, they have to provide it. I don't think it's a problem.
Fine.
Comrade Den?
Chair, Mr. David Lari stole most of my thunder, and I have to concede it because it's a fellow of Western Cape. So,
And Sisa?
Well, I haven't heard him yet, so I'm fair to say.
Hurry up.
I'll just be quick. I just want to chair on the tribunal, ask Mr. Dave Lewis. He mentioned that three of these members, that term expire at the end of the month.
Yes,
and that they've been extended by cabinet for the next 5 years. Was that an automatic extension? Was there not an opportunity where those positions have been advertised so that other people could come in? What was the process and procedure that you went about to make the recommendation to Parliament, I would say, and who did the recommendation? Secondly, is I just want to make a comment on, I've said it last year, so I just want to repeat again, this problem was well, these fines, it's a serious problem for us. Because we said it last year and it was proven that what these guys are doing, they say up yours. Finish the club, we pay the money, we'll take it from the consumer. and that's what's happening. I think we need to, isn't there a mechanism that we do something more stiffer in terms of looking at these people in the future? The other comment I want to make is, in Afrikaans, which is my mother tongue, we say, Osuha neighbor me splinter na ana oos oof to see, vergeet die balk in jou oof. In other words, we always look at faults that the other person forgets. We are also at faults. We have state enterprises. They're killing this nation. Telkom, Eskom, the works. And the question one would want to ask, isn't there a way in somewhere, and maybe that would come down to legislation, where we have a structure like yourself to look at these particular institutions also, because there is running riots amongst our people. And yet we're looking at Tiger Brands. In the meantime, we get killed by our own folks here, right here, and we're saying nothing about it. I just thought I want to make that comment, and probably as a committee or some structure in parliament or government to look at this particular process. Thank you.
Thanks, Comrade Dent. I don't see any further hands.
These are gone. Thank you.
Yeah, you have spoken on behalf of our community. You have covered everything. Good folks, your chance for a rejoinder. A very interesting basket of comments and questions. At liberty to answer all of them.
Thank you, Chair. There is quite a big basket, and if I haven't answered anything, please get back to me. I'll try to clump them because there were different people asked questions around similar things. The question as to whether about building strategic alliances and me not mentioning business, we certainly not averse to building alliances with business associations, business bodies, you know, umbrella bodies. Indeed, one of our key strategies under that advocacy section is to target industry associations, which you know, for good industry associations are sometimes cold or cartel. In other words, a lot of industry associations, while they might have legitimate work to do in, say, maintaining standards or some level of professionalism or quality or, you know, some kind of health and safety issues, you know, there might be areas that are common, there might be good reasons for them to be industry associations. They often double up as cartels. It's often where prices and information is exchanged between people. So that's a very important, it's very important to kind of win over at that level, buy-in into competition principles so that that can kind of go down to their members. But certainly we're not averse to that. That hasn't happened. That, you know, also insofar as legal practitioners are representatives of businesses, we interact a lot with them. I must say on this point, you know, it is kind of noticeable that in the recent public debates occurring around you know, our high-profile cartel cases in bread and milk and pharmaceuticals, there has been a lot of people that have had their say in public over these issues. And indeed, you know, in the recent past, news around the work of the Competition Commission and the Tribunal have got off the business pages of the newspaper into the main sections. I mean, this is a fairly recent thing. And the point that we are not well known is a point that we take, well taken, you know, well made point. But I think that we are beginning to become more well known, and there's a number of strategies we're using around that. One is to use the media more effectively to put our messages out there and to get an understanding of what we do. But also we interact a lot with individual organizations and associations who are called upon to give, you know, to give inputs to them on various issues. And we also kind of give, people make requests to us fairly often, but we're also proactive in kind of targeting different constituencies that we feel need, you know, we need to target, for example, the industry association. Okay, there were questions around, there were a bunch of HR questions approving market-related salaries, training and development graduates. Why aren't we keeping our graduate trainees? Well, you know, our graduate trainee program is the graduate trainee program we do in the spirit of the Skills Development Act, kind of creating opportunities for recent graduates to get job experience, primarily. And we have about 20 people in that graduate training program. We can't absorb all of them into the organization. The purpose of it is to give people just that experience, and they must go out there and find other jobs. So this is not only, we're not doing it exclusively to recruit people, although it is a very good recruiting ground for us, where we can plug people back into the organization. We can't absorb all of them. But certainly they're kind of not lost to the country. You know, whoever else they're working for, they're taking that experience with them to that job. Okay, there were a lot of questions around banks. Okay, I'll leave the banks question to Chilani. There is a question that I'll ask Talani and maybe even Dave to comment on, and it's a question a number of people have asked, and it's a question that everybody asks, you know, the question of, well, you're finding these cartels, and all that's happening is they're passing on the cost of the fine to the consumer. This is a well-known gripe. And it's a difficult issue. There's no kind of straightforward answer to this question. Except to say a few things. One is, you know, it is not illegal to raise prices. You can't. Okay, I suppose the first point is developing an appreciation that the competition authorities don't set prices. We can't tell anybody what price is the correct price. Our job is to basically remove those behaviors by businesses that contorts the price, that manipulates the price. So we remove the behavior. You will not collude anymore. You will not behave in these particular ways. And when we remove that behavior, what ought to happen is the prices ought to settle at a competitive place. But we can't say this is the correct price to anybody. It's not illegal to raise prices. There can't be a law against that. It's also not true that prices are that in competitive markets prices also go up. Doesn't mean in competitive markets prices are always going to stay the same or fall. You know, if any company has a higher costs of production, though, prices will definitely go up. And in the bread case, I think the sequence of events there were a very unfortunate sequence of events, and I think that, you know, I think that the bread companies themselves kind of regret having, after so soon, of being kind of found by the competition authorities for collusion, having to raise their prices. We've asked them for explanations on that, and by and large, the explanations were about rising costs of grain, of wheat, and rising transport costs, and that's the kind of justification they gave for why those prices went up. We're busy kind of analyzing in more detail now the kind of response they've given us. We responded to that in public by saying, you know, we're not entirely convinced, because to start off with, their prices were already high. So they, on already existing high prices, they raised it up further. And it was just strange and bizarre to us that once again they all decided to do it at the same time by the same amount, which is a sure indication of some sort of communication between them. So, and whether or not they've passed it on to the consumer, you know, I maybe others have comments to make on that, but I mean, I wouldn't imagine a once-off payment like that gets passed on to the consumer in the normal running of a business. You know, that must reflect in their balance sheet, but it will reflect in their balance sheet one way or the other. I think that it's not only the consumer that is affected here. It may well be that some of this cost is passed on, but clearly the constituency, the stakeholder that bears most of these costs in the end are shareholders as well. And we've also made calls to shareholders to begin to hold their management, their respective managements more accountable. I'd like perhaps Tulani and Dave to say anything else about that question, but it is a difficult question, and it's just kind of very counterintuitive things happening. You don't expect this to happen, but that's what's going on. I don't know if I've answered all the questions there, but I mean the point about a basic foodstuff disproportionately affecting poor people is well taken. There was a question about asking whether making the link between the high turnover and how we would establish the commission as a center of knowledge and expertise and questions around staff morale. Look, I think, and what loopholes in HR policies? You know, there aren't any specific loopholes in HR policies that have driven this, but we wanted to kind of ensure that all our policies are consistent with best practices policies in this area. With regard to the turnover question, I mean, I think that, you know, it's precisely because of this scenario. The way I understand it is, well, if you're having high turnover, how do you maintain an institutional memory that truly can establish you as a center of knowledge and expertise? If you're losing staff all the time, you're not going to establish yourself as a center of knowledge and expertise. And that's why we are putting so much of emphasis on that knowledge management system. Because in some ways, a knowledge management system, we will design it in order to make the assumption that we're going to lose a lot of staff. So the knowledge must be retained in the organization, notwithstanding this turnover. You know, a new person coming in must be able to use a computer program. You were not here 4 years ago, but you must be able to access that information from 4 years ago and get up to speed on it as quickly as possible. And that's the whole idea behind a knowledge management system, is to kind of ensure continuity and institutional memory, and that we've learned from what's previously done. And as I pointed out, this is kind of will be, there are some level of IT, you know, kind of technology that will enable this thing. Where we said clarify roles and responsibilities, it's not a question of they're not being clarified or they're not being clear or there's a big problem here. Basically, you know, you've got an organization that is divided into different divisions that do different areas of work. But inevitably in an organization like this, our best outputs, our best work occurs when an issue is dealt with across divisions. You know, say, take any issue, infrastructure, say, you know, the policy guys would do the policy research work, the investigators are investigating, you know, the registry is receiving documents. There's an involvement, there's hierarchical structures going up, top down, but major outputs in the organization occur across divisions. And we want to, if you look at our objectives, we want to maximize that. We want to be able to not keep everybody working in silos, but kind of getting this cross-cutting communication and cross-cutting collaboration between the divisions working better. Now, you'd imagine that that's something that now does blur where who's boss and where the you know, where the roles and responsibility lies for moving a project if they're being run across different divisions. And the idea here is to kind of work with that in a way that that makes it efficient, that doesn't create confusion around the question of roles and responsibilities. There was a question about giving voice and how and how well known we are. I mean, how well known we are. I've spoken about using the medium or effectively speaking to individual institutions more and more. And the question of giving voice is about getting organizations and institutions and organized groups of people that have any interest on any particular matter we're dealing with to participate both in the investigative stage, so where we can get information from people in order to enable us to do better prosecution, as well as in the hearing stage where Dave spoke about the public nature of these hearings, where people come and have their say about what their issues or interests are. There was a quick question about consultants. You know, that's a great question. I share those views around consultants. Certainly, you know, I feel quite strongly about consultants not replacing or not doing the work of staff that have been employed to do a particular piece of work. The problem here is that maybe we've used the word incorrectly, but when we use the word consultants in that graph, we're not only talking about kind of HR consultants or payroll consultants or people who are involved in those things, but for our purposes, consultants also include economic experts. So economic experts are not quite lawyers, but they like lawyers. You know, so maybe that's the confusion there. We haven't clumped consultancies, you know, in non-case related and case related. We haven't distinguished very clearly between them. But a lot of our consultants are case related consultants, and we need an economic expert in the steel industry to write a report. So, and that's equivalent to the work that lawyers do. There was a question about whether mergers and acquisitions are good or bad for the economy. Maybe Dave should also pick up on that one. It's to say that according to the Competition Act, a merger is bad for the economy if it leads to higher levels of concentration in a particular market and is likely to prevent or lessen competition. And a merger is not necessarily a bad thing if it leads to efficiency gains. There's maybe you can speak more to that. Advocacy, I've spoken about. No, I'm not familiar with CDWs, but it's something we would be interested to deal with. I'm going to get to Nani to speak a little bit about banks in some detail in that, but just to say that I have been invited to the Financial Sector Coalition meeting and will be speaking at that meeting around our banking inquiry. So I'll just ask Nani to speak a little bit about the banks and the big rigging. Yeah, banks, big rigging.
Before
before I do that, there's the issue around the changes that address around HR, why we want to also relook at the policies and our roles and responsibilities, redefining them. Is we've done this whole strategic process. So we've changed the way that the organization basically is going to be working, and we've got particular areas of focus. So the question that we're not looking at gaps, we're looking at are these policies aligned with what we want to set ourselves to achieve. So you change and you define the roles and responsibilities, and you change your human resource policies as well, so that they are policies that will enable you to achieve what you set out to achieve. On the question of banking, I think maybe we need to just clarify the process. What we have up to now is we've had two reports which have indicated that there may be problems, competition problems in banking. And as a result of those reports, we set up an independent panel that was set up within the commission, but we got external people to run it. And the brief of that panel was to take those reports that have been given to it and identify if there are, in fact, any particular competition issues, and make recommendations to the commission on what needs to be done around those, if there are any competition issues. This was necessary because the banking industry is a very complex industry. Internally within the commission, we do not have any people with financial skills. We will be getting people with financial skills. So we set up a panel of experts. We're expecting a report at the end of the month, and the three possible outcomes from that report, and maybe all three will form part of the report. And one is that they might say that there are competition issues. Maybe the banks are colluding, or the banks are engaged in some form of contravention, and in which case they will recommend that we investigate it. Shen has already referred to the possibility of that there are problems around the governance of banks, in which case perhaps the recommendation would be that we look at influencing the legislative and policy making processes to change those structures that are not in the financial sector, that are not benefiting the consumer. Or in certain areas they might say that there are no problems and there's no need for us to intervene. So apart from setting up that structure, we haven't started any investigations into banking. It's only at the end of that process and after we've looked at the recommendations of that independent panel that we will then decide on what interventions we're going to make. On the issue of bid rigging, what we've started to do is we've run a workshop last year. We realized this is a big issue, and that's why we set up the infrastructure program. But we've also realized that one of the ways to prevent it is if we impart whatever knowledge we have on bid rigging to state-owned institutions, which we think are the biggest victims when it comes to bid rigging. So last year we ran a workshop where we invited all of the big institutions that also issue a lot of their business through bids, and we take them through how do you recognize bid rigging, and we've also been taking them through how do you set out your bids so that you can minimize the possibility of bid rigging. We've also, on the invitation of particular enterprises, 2 weeks ago we were in ESCOM because they asked us particularly to come and address their procurement people on bid rigging. So we're doing a lot of proactive work. The infrastructure team is doing a lot of the reactive work. We are looking at investigating potential areas of concern. Cement, aggregates, steel, we've had a team that is part of the infrastructure team. Our economists in that team have done exercises, research, tracking price trends and other information which we will use to decide whether this is an area that whether the information indicates potential concerns, and we will then initiate investigation as necessary. There are areas in that, some of those areas we've already initiated complaints because the information that the team has come up with has indicated that the pricing information is problematic. On the bread issue, Shane has said most of the what I was going to say there. Our intervention is to create we intervene to create a competitive environment. And the idea is that competition creates market will result in competitive prices. That doesn't mean that prices will never rise. It does mean that prices are more likely to reflect the conditions that are prevailing in the market.
I'll try and answer some of the questions that were posed to me, but maybe to just take off of the last point first, the question of pricing and whether fines are passed down and what we expect. It's interesting to hear how people talk in this country, and there's some reasons for the way we talk, including the members of the committee and including members of the competition authority. But we would like to hear people, our aim would be for people not to be saying the price of bread has gone up to 8.50 rand, but rather, if you like to hear Baba Dada say, the price of Pioneer bread has gone up to 8.50 rand, and to hear another member of the committee say, well, that's okay because the price of Sasco has remained at 7.50 rand. That's what we want to hear. And that's what our cartel work is aimed at doing, is making sure that no people think about price of bread or price of milk or price of steel. You talk about the price of a particular manufacturer's product, and that you end this business where all prices go up at the same time by the same amount. And that's what we would hope to achieve by the cartel busting activity. And so even if, for example, one producer decides to pass its fine down to consumers, we would hope that another producer sees this as an opportunity not to pass the fine down to the consumers in order to get a larger share of the market. That's what cartel busting activity is about. Now, in the food sector, it is true that globally food prices are rising very quickly, and it's a really major problem for governments and most particularly for poor consumers all over the world. I'm not going to explain to the bread producers why their prices have gone up, but I am going to say that if the Competition Commission is of the view that the prices have gone up at the same time by the same price, then I think that their alarm bells, I'm pretty sure, will start ringing in the Competition Commission, because as I say, I would like to be able to go into a shop and look at the price of brown bread and say, well, this price of brown bread is 8.50 rand, but look at the next shelf where somebody else's brown bread is and see that it's only cost 7.80 rand. But because these prices in the past have been regulated prices by the cooperatives or by the government or by whatever the case is, we've become used to the fact that bread and milk and key commodities like that have one price. And we want to, and the aim of the cartel busting activity is to break that. You know, on the question of who the fines harm, I think that, as I've said, if we generate competition in the economy, then some will pass it down, others won't pass it down, some will pass some down, others will pass none down, and the process of competition will start because we've prevented them from cooperating with each other. But shareholders are grievously affected by fines sometimes, and consumers are affected by cartel activity. What we want to start seeing is I think class action suits where consumers actually sue people who've been found guilty of cartel behavior for the effects that it has had upon them. Now, in the case of bread, it is difficult to mount a class action suit because there are so many consumers, and the damage to each single consumer is relatively small, even though the total damage to the whole economy and to the whole group of consumers is very large. And I think that in future we will start to see class action suits where people or companies that are found guilty of an offence under the Competition Act are sued for private damages by private complainants. Now, in our law, in order to do that, they would have to go to the High Court, not to establish the offence, but once we have established an offence, they would simply take that ruling to the High Court and ask for damages. And we've just recently had our first case in that regard, where Nationwide Airlines, on the basis of a finding that we made against South African Airways, sued South African Airways for damages in the High Court. We fined South African Airways, in that instance, I think, 45 million rand, and Nationwide sued them for 300 million rand worth of damages. Now, there was a settlement reached that was a confidential settlement before the court was able to pronounce on it, and so I don't know what the extent of the damages was, but I think that that will be a very important development in the unfolding of competition law. The second thing that I think is potentially interesting, which Shan mentioned, is when shareholders start to say, we do not like the idea that the board of directors that we have appointed have allowed price fixing to take place in the economy, and we do not like the fact that we have to be responsible for the fine that was paid. Now, I don't know if many of you saw, or if any of you saw, that after the bread cartel was fined in the consent order before the tribunal, the PIC, who I think are the largest shareholder in Tiger, mentioned that they were considering suing the directors of Tiger because they didn't see why they should take the hit for the company's activities. I don't think that they've proceeded with that, and you know, maybe they were well advised not to. I have no knowledge of that. But when that sort of thing starts happening, I think you'll also see a lot more bite in these activities. But as Tulani has said, what our objective is to do is to create competitive markets and prevent conduct that fixes prices at higher levels than they would otherwise be fixed. To some of the other questions, the CV of the panel members, I'm more than happy to let the committee have. I think, in fact, they might even be on the website, but you can have them. You know, I just will say that of the members here, very briefly, their qualifications are in the annual report, which I think you all have. But two are senior counsel, three are economists, and the remainder are attorneys of varying degrees of experience and various specializations. The appeal court that hears appeals from the Competition Tribunal is the Competition Appeal Court, which is a special court of appeal made up of sitting judges in the various provincial divisions of the High Court. And there is an appeal, in fact, even beyond the Competition Appeal Court to the Supreme Court of Appeal. We don't usually appear before the appeal court in any capacity. There are occasions where in a merger case, for example, I won't go into the legal details of this, but sometimes the commission recommends the approval of the merger, and obviously the merging parties agree with the commission that their merger should be approved. We prohibit the merger because we don't agree with the commission's recommendation. We prohibit the merger and the party appeals, and there is nobody to defend our decision in the High Court, that in the appeal court. That has been something of a problem, but what the appeal court has sometimes done is appointed what are called friends of the court to come and represent our opinion. But although I often long to be able to go before the appeal court and argue for our support for our decisions, I'm told, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm told that's not a proper thing for a lower adjudicative body to do, so we don't get to do that, unfortunately. Martini asked about how we deal with the drain on our members, and several others have asked that. You know, I think that, as I said, I think that salaries are one way of dealing with it, and trying to come closer to private sector salaries is one way of doing it. But we will never be able to compete with law firms in terms of salaries, and we will never be able to compete with a big economic and strategy consultant in terms of salaries. And I think that all that we can do is try and make our workplace a stimulating workplace. We provide much more opportunity for training than private firms do. We provide opportunities for people to attend conferences. Our researchers are even able to occasionally attend international conferences and international training activities. And I think that that's the only way that we can do it, and to hope to renew our place as a place where people want to come and work. There was a question asked about the three people who have just been reappointed. It's the DTI who makes the recommendation to the minister, who then makes the recommendation to cabinet. On this occasion, they didn't advertise. I think they usually advertise when there's a big bulk of tribunal members to be appointed, as will be the case in about a year's time. I'm sure that there will then be an advertisement. I will just say about those three members that they've served one term, and it takes a long time to get to know this kind of work. They were all part-time members, and I think that it was very wise to reappoint them. Madlanga is a very well-known senior counsel, in fact, used to be on the High Court and a very valued member of the tribunal. Laurie Rayburn is a semi-retired lawyer with great expertise in intellectual property law, which is a very difficult issue that often comes before the tribunal, and because he is semi-retired, amongst the part-time members, he's more readily available to serve on panels than many of the other part-timers are. And so, and Tanya Lane is, again, a very experienced attorney, and so I'm pleased that they were reappointed. Of our full-time members, three full-time members, one is an economist and two are lawyers. Of our full complement, eight are lawyers and three are economists. I will just say about that a competition law is unusual because of its interface between law and economics. And I don't mean commerce and economics. I mean commerce and law. I mean law and economics and economic theory. And the lawyers learn how to be economists, and the economists learn how to be lawyers in the process of actually doing the work. And so the divide is not as great as one might imagine it is, but it nevertheless does require specialized expertise. And so, as I say, we have an 8-3 division. I think the optimum is probably a 7-4 division, but we manage fairly adequately with the divisions that we have. Underspending and high expenditure on personnel. Our personnel is really our only significant asset. We don't have cars and machinery and all of those other things. And so it would inevitably be the case that our personnel cost would be our highest cost. Our underspending is a consequence of having to maintain some sort of reserve in the event of unforeseen litigation. And I sometimes worry that we could get one very significant bout of litigation that could wipe out that reserve at a single blow. And that's why we generally spend between sort of 85% to 95% of our budget, because it's unclear when we would have to engage in litigation. Are mergers and acquisitions good or bad for the economy? Most mergers don't have any particular impact on the economy. Some are good and a few are bad. And from our point of view, they are bad when they result in the test in legislation and the statute is when they result in a substantial lessening of competition. And that is a very complex and lengthy inquiry. But mergers are sometimes generally a very good thing for the economy. They are part of the natural process of restructuring. Sometimes they are between firms of equal size. When they are between large firms of equal size, I think that's when the commission particularly sits up and takes a hard look at them, because those are the kind of mergers that usually are problematic from a competition point of view. Sometimes they are large firms buying small firms, and that can be a very good thing. When an entrepreneur has developed a firm, it's a successful firm, but he or she needs more capital invested in its business. Often the only way to do that is to sell the shares of that business to a larger firm and then expand the smaller business. So mergers can be very good for the economy and very good for the corporation. Our task is just to prevent those mergers that cause a substantial lessening of competition. And the idea there is that firms should ideally grow by producing better products at lower prices, not by absorbing other firms. I think that was about all the questions that were asked directly of me, but it's a question about the IDC issue. I'm a non-executive board member of the IDC. I have been for a long time. My background is in industrial economics, and I guess that's the history of my involvement with the IDC. I mean, why I raised it as an example is sometimes the IDC may be involved in a transaction that has to be approved by the competition authorities. Now, in that case, I would recuse myself from any involvement in the competition decision, and I would generally recuse myself from any involvement in the IDC board decision around something that I knew would come before the commission. And the same goes for quite a few other members of the tribunal. They may find that a client of their law firm is appearing before the tribunal, they would recuse themselves from any involvement in something like that. But it doesn't cause a certainly not a problem in terms of time. If I've left out anything else, please come back to me. But I think that's all that was asked of me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis and Shen. Members, any further questions, comments, Comrade Lenz?
Yeah, thank you, President. I just want to check the both of presenters, their view or opinion in relation to price control. If you were to say, hang on, this is getting out of control. In particular, if you look at the food price, I'm told that there is a riot also in other countries around the food price. And there's something that is coming up very big in terms of the underdeveloped countries in relation to that one. Even before the consumers say, you know, enough is enough now, government, what are you doing? So maybe like what the brother Mugabe did to say 50%. All prices, you know. Well, I'm not saying that's the case, but I just want to check around the price control, what was the view on that? Because really, really, it's very, very clear. The other issue, Chair, which I think maybe needs also to be just from the Competition Tribunal, I raised the question of your fertilizer and other related issues. I just want to hear your comment in terms of. You raised an issue that I made an example about SASCO, that was a letter that was sent to a number of businesses from SASCO. You see, that sometimes they just increase right across the board. You know, not only maybe a shop A say 650, a shop B 550, because we want to get more clients to them or customers, but just right across the board. Then what is your reaction in terms of that? Maybe I think the other issue that I thought was not properly coming from It's a question of, no, the usage of consultants, I think we are covered by competition. And yeah, I think that is all, Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Congressman. And that has me.
Now, for me, Chair, just for to say a comment to say that I think we need to be moving faster in reacting to those issues that are within our mandate, like this bid rigging issue. It's why some politicians have been complaining for quite a long time. Now, an institution of government has actually reported on it within the public service. I haven't had you, you know, actually pointing to the public service, except indicating the other institutions like ESCOM and so on. Within the departments themselves, you know, government is there to render services to the public out there and other companies, etc., etc. But if then you would find government itself to be, you know, apportioning benefits to itself, something terrible, you know, because that points out to a scenario where you would have everybody else up in arms against government and things, you know, collapse like they did in many other areas, Kenya and so on, because of the elections, as it would be because of other things. So I think we would want to see business unusual actually mounted by our competition commission. Thank you.
Thanks, folks. Your chance for a return.
On some of those, I think we leave the bid rigging question to the commission because it hasn't come before us. I don't know what goes on there. You know, on the question of price control, competition authorities generally don't favour price control. So I think that our job is to ensure that the market is sufficiently competitive and producers in the market are sufficiently rivalrous to generate a price that is a competitive and that's our philosophy. I mean, if you want to see that spelled out in a lot of detail about our approach to that, a decision to read is our decision in the Mittal Steel case, where there are a lot of complaints about the price of steel, and we, in our judgment, introduced remedies apart from the fine that attempted to set competitive conditions in that market. But there are times when price regulation is unavoidable, and that would not be the role of the competition authority, but that would be the role of the executive, and it would be the role of a regulator like ICASA or like NERSA to set the price of a particular product. And it is a very difficult and complex activity because you have to set a price that generates a sufficient return on investment to continue investing in the activity whilst not being so high as to generate excessive profits. And you see the controversies every time ICASA sets the price or NERSA sets the price. It is a very, very difficult decision to arrive at. And as competition authorities, our preference is to say where competition can be effective in the market, that is the process that will arrive at a price that consumers will be able to bear, and at which producers will be able to produce profitably. Comrade Redmond asked about administered prices and about our relationship with state-owned enterprises whose prices are regulated. But if you read often complaints of the Reserve Bank governor and others, administered prices are amongst the most rapidly rising prices in the society. There is a very big issue over the question of who has jurisdiction over anti-competitive practices in those industries. that has never been satisfactorily resolved and hopefully will be satisfactorily resolved in legislation in the future. But the regulators generally have authority over maximum pricing, although there is generally nothing to stop producers charging a price less than the maximum that was set by the regulator. So in the telecommunications industry, there are competing service providers. Prices are regulated, but there is the possibility of competition. Now, the question is, do they or do they not compete? Or do they simply agree to pay to charge the regulated price? But there is a very big legal difficulty. I mean, who precisely has authority in those areas?
Just before you, Chair, Mr. Lewis, thanks. I think for the purposes of the meeting, leave the comrades to call each other comrades. Mm. But if you are going to call them comrades, it might create problems for you.
Mm.
It's a multi-party committee. Today it might not be an issue, but there might be a sensitive issue discussed, and your judgment will be flawed on a non-issue. So I'm just saying, let's pay this in mind. I, as the chairperson, I don't want to know about your political leanings or what is. I just see presenters during the meeting.
I apologize for that. It's just that I was in the union.
I know.
A long time ago.
I know.
I never called him. I thought it was his first name.
Okay. That's fine. That's fine. Shan?
Okay, I'll be very quick. I think, just to echo, Dave's response on the price control issue is something I would kind of go along with. Just to point out that, you know, you have to appreciate that the instincts of an institution like ours is going to be, it's going to be very wary of something like price control. And to remember also that, you know, what the bread industry has done is a form of price control, except that in that instance it's done by private individuals meeting together from each one of those firms, sitting down and deciding to set the price at a particular level. Now, of course, there may be a good argument to say that, you know, government or more objective government institution setting the price is better than a bunch of private individuals setting the price, because you can hold governments and political governments accountable more than you can hold CEOs accountable. There might be a good argument for that, but it boils down to the same thing in our view: setting the price and not allowing the prices to change according to market conditions, or, you know, to be responsive to what's going on in the market, is something that we will instinctively be very, very wary of. Which is not to say that there might be good reasons in exceptional circumstances to set prices. The issue around bid rigging and whether we're working with the Public Service Commission, we haven't had any direct contact over perhaps what you're talking about in the private. There isn't any specific issue we've dealt with them about, and I'm not completely aware of what they've done around this issue. But certainly, as Tulani's pointed out, we have held meetings with, we've held a seminar with procuring departments and had explained and what our role here is, how you design tenders so that they can, you can avoid kind of rigging behavior, how to identify bids that have been rigged. This is a lot of work that we intend to do with procuring government departments. It also is, interestingly, work that's being done internationally. So when we were at the OECD meeting last, one of the next topics for discussion coming up is how can competition agencies assist their government departments to deal with this issue. So it is something that we you know, we'll take up, and your point around speeding up is well taken. Just remember, I mean, bid rigging, you know, bid rigging can occur with or without corruption. Okay? I think it's reasonable to assume that when bid rigging occurs, there's likely to be corruption. In other words, you know, bid rigging is what the company, the private companies do. Corruption is what the government officials do in order to either facilitate that or not. And we've got to address both those issues, although we kind of not specifically an anti-corruption agency in the traditional sense. On this issue, we have to work together with whatever it is the Public Service Commission is coming up with on this issue.
Can I just make one comment about bid rigging? Is it the parliamentary oversight committee have a big role to play in the whole question of bid rigging? Because the reason why, and it's not only in South Africa, I mean the figures from the United States are truly shocking, but the reason why it is easy to collude against the government is because they're not paying their own, the officials are not paying their own money or their own company's money or their own shareholders' money for the goods that they buy. They're buying it with taxpayers' money. And so that's why it's easy to bid rig against government. It doesn't only take place against government, but it's why government is often a victim of bid rigging. And so those who have oversight over the expenditure of government departments or local government departments or provincial government departments are very often important instruments in limiting the phenomenon of bid rigging.
Thank you very much, Kutuk. I think in regard to the presentations that you said this morning, our past practice shows that if and when we need to call you for us to be able to assist in dealing with any matter of public interest, we will continue to do so. And then obviously we could not have exhausted all the comments that we would have liked to make and nor received all the possible answers, but I'd rather want to view this as an ongoing process of interaction, vibrant interaction, where there are issues that you think that from our level we might be able to assist. Please call on us to do so, and likewise, where we see that there are issues that members of the portfolio committee find important for you to give greater clarity on, so that they can interact with the issues in their constituencies and also to raise matters in Parliament, in the plenary, then we'll also knock on your door to be able to enable us to carry out that function. Presenters, the entire delegation, even those who did not get a chance to say anything, but we saw you passing notes, so you did earn your living. And I would like to thank all members and stakeholders who have traversed this road with us since this morning. Thank you very much, good folks. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
May? There's no study group today for members of the ANC. Just to remind you that we do have portfolio committee meetings on the 26th and on the 27th. 26th and 27th of this month, of March. The Director General has also tabled his apology that he would not be able to be on his listening group today, but I'm sure we'll see him sometime the next time we meet. Thank you.